Welcome to another deep dive. Today we're venturing into a really compelling area that's generating, well, significant attention in health and wellness. Peptides? You've likely heard the term, right? Maybe seen it mentioned for recovery or anti-aging.
Oh yeah, it's buzzing.
But in this deep dive, we'll peel back the layers, really unpack exactly what they are, how they work, and, you know, their remarkable potential for your health and recovery journey.
Definitely.
Get ready for some compelling insights and practical knowledge that can genuinely empower your understanding. This deep dive, by the way, is brought to you by InfinityPeptide.com. They've made it possible for us to bring you this in-depth exploration today.
Great stuff.
We've got a fantastic stack of sources for today's discussion, including a really insightful masterclass from Max Lugavere, which really shines a light on this cutting-edge field.
He does great.
Our mission. Explore these compounds with an upbeat, informative perspective, focusing on their immense potential and, of course, the crucial considerations for their responsible and effective use.
Indeed. And it's really about moving beyond just the superficial buzz you might see online, you know, and diving deep into the, well, the robust science behind these remarkable molecules.
Exactly.
We'll explore everything from their fundamental nature, like what they're actually made of, to their specific applications in accelerating healing, optimizing recovery, enhancing overall well-being.
Mm-hmm.
What's truly fascinating here, I think, is how these relatively small chains of amino acids
mm-hmm.
can exert such profound, precise, and targeted impacts on the body.
Yay.
Essentially offering powerful tools for health optimization. It's a field just brimming with exciting possibilities.
Okay, let's unpack this then. When most people hear peptide, they often conjure up images of something cutting edge, maybe, I don't know, a bit futuristic, or incredibly new on the scene.
Yeah, that's the vibe.
But is this perception accurate? Are peptides truly some revolutionary new discovery, or have they been part of our scientific understanding for, well, much longer than we realize?
That's a great question, and it's a common misconception. It's actually far from the truth. The perception, like you said, often focuses on very specific newer compounds, maybe less than 40 or 50 amino acids long.
Right, the really targeted ones.
Exactly. But fundamentally, at their core, peptides are simply chains of amino acids, just strings of them.
Okay.
Their length can range widely, I mean, from just two amino acids linked together, all the way up to maybe a couple of hundred.
Wow.
And this broad definition is really key, because it means that some very familiar, even life-saving substances that have been foundational to medicine and wellness for decades are, in fact, peptides.
Ah, I see.
We've known about them, used them, depended on them for a long, long time. We just don't always label them as peptides in, you know, everyday conversation.
That distinction really broadens our understanding, puts them in context. So can you give us some concrete examples, maybe some of these familiar everyday peptides that might genuinely surprise our listeners?
Absolutely. Let's start with something many of your listeners are likely familiar with, especially if they're into fitness.
Creatine.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Staple supplement. Right. Known for boosting strength and power. Mm-hmm. But did you know creatine is actually a tripeptide?
No, really?
Yeah, just three amino acids linked together. Right. Glycine, arginine, methionine. It's been widely researched, used for decades. Yet, you know, few people think peptide when they think creatine.
Huh. Mind blown already. Okay, what else?
Well, then there's insulin.
Okay, the big one for diabetes.
Exactly. This is perhaps the original, the OG life-saving peptide that completely revolutionized diabetes management for millions.
Yeah.
Discovered over a century ago, its therapeutic use has transformed countless lives, allowing people with diabetes to manage their blood sugar effectively. Insulin is a complex peptide hormone.
Right.
It just shows the profound impact these molecules can have on fundamental physiological processes. It's been around so long, it's almost like taken for granted as just a drug rather than specifically a peptide.
That makes sense. And more recently?
More recently, yeah. Compounds like the GLP-1 agonists have truly captured public and scientific attention. Huge buzz.
Oh, absolutely. Ozempic, yeah. Mounjaro.
Exactly. We're talking about substances like semaglutide, which you might know by brand names like Ozempic or Wegovy.
Yeah.
And tirzepatide, known as Mounjaro or Zepbound.
Yep.
These have gained massive attention for their remarkable effectiveness in weight management and diabetes treatment.
Yeah.
And yes, you guessed it, they're also peptides.
Fascinating.
They work by mimicking a natural gut hormone, GLP-1, to regulate appetite, slow down how fast your stomach empties, and improve insulin secretion. So this wide spectrum, you know, from creatine to insulin to GLP-1s, it illustrates just how varied their applications in history are.
Right.
And why this recent spotlight in health optimization is so exciting.
That's incredibly insightful, connecting them to substances we already recognize and use. So now we know what they are. What does this all mean for how they actually function in our bodies? How do these different lengths and structures lead to such precise actions?
Okay, yeah, good question. To really understand their action, we need to think about them like, well, any sophisticated medication, or even a highly specific supplement you might take. We look at two things, pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics.
Okay, break those down for us. Pharmacokinetics first.
Right. Pharmacokinetics is basically the peptide's journey through your body, how it gets absorbed, like if you take it orally, inject it, use a cream, then how it distributes itself throughout your tissues and organs. Next, how quickly it's metabolized, you know, broken down by enzymes, maybe in the liver or bloodstream. And finally, how your body gets rid of it, usually through the kidneys.
Okay.
This life cycle is crucial because a lot of potential side effects, or even just whether a peptide will work well, are tied to these properties.
Like how long it lasts.
Exactly. If it's cleared too quickly, you might need frequent doses. If it spreads too widely, maybe unintended effects elsewhere.
Gotcha. And pharmacodynamics, how's that different?
Pharmacodynamics, on the other hand, that describes the compound's actual action on the body, what it truly does at a cellular or systemic level.
The mechanism.
Precisely. Does it bind to a specific receptor, like a unique key in a specific lock?
Okay.
Does it then kick off a cascade of biochemical events, turn things on, turn things off, leading to, say, tissue regeneration or hormone production?
I see.
This distinction, how the body handles the compound versus what the compound does to the body, is absolutely crucial. It helps us understand both the intended benefits and any potential downsides or considerations, especially with peptides, because many are known for being highly targeted.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned amino acids earlier, and that immediately makes me think of collagen peptides. Super popular right now, right? In powders, drinks, everything. Yeah. How do they fit into this picture?
Collagen peptides, yeah, another excellent and very common example of amino acid strengths, but with a bit of a unique twist.
Okay.
So while some people might take individual amino acids, like, say, glutamine for gut health, collagen peptides are still strung together, but they're much shorter chains than the huge collagen proteins naturally found in your body.
Okay. Pre-digested, kind of.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
When you ingest them, your body works to break them down further into even smaller peptides or individual amino acids. These get absorbed, and then your body can rebundle them to synthesize its own collagen or other proteins.
For what purpose?
Building and repairing connective tissues all over skin, tendons, ligaments, joints. It's like providing the specific raw materials in an easy-to-use form.
And are there different types? Because you see type 1, type 2, type 3. It gets confusing. What are the benefits there?
That's a great point. Yeah, the source matters. Bovine collagen from cows typically gives you type 1 and type 3. These are the most abundant types in our body, so they're often linked with benefits for skin, hair, nails, bones.
Okay, the beauty benefits people talk about.
Exactly. Then there's chicken-derived collagen, which is usually type 2. That's the main type found in cartilage, so it's primarily relevant for cartilage health, bone health, and overall joint support. Now, at a high-level view, it's important to clarify something. While people often take collagen hoping for, like, dramatic aesthetic changes.
Yeah, better skin overnight.
Right. And it can contribute to skin health and hydration, but controlled trials show it's not necessarily going to give you that instant transformation.
Okay.
Where they really shine, and where the science is very strong, is in their measurable impact on connective tissues. Studies show they demonstrably increase tendon thickness and springiness, or elasticity.
Wow, okay. That's significant.
Absolutely. Crucial for active folks, athletes, or anyone looking to support the resilience of their tendons and ligaments, maybe prevent injuries.
So who might benefit most from adding collagen peptides?
Well, for our listeners, if your diet is maybe lower in foods like bone broth or organ meats, or maybe you just don't eat much meat right off the bone, or if you follow a mostly plant-based diet, incorporating collagen peptides can be hugely beneficial. It helps ensure you're getting those specific building blocks that might be less common in your regular meals, supporting your structural integrity.
Makes sense. Filling a potential gap.
Exactly.
Okay, moving on. It certainly seems like peptides have really gained significant traction lately. They've moved beyond just, you know, specialized medical uses into the broader health and wellness space. Why the sudden buzz? Is it just hype? social media? Or is something more profound driving this excitement?
It's definitely more profound than just social media, although, you know, influencers have certainly played a role in raising awareness, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, gets the conversation started.
True.
But the recent excitement fundamentally stems from compelling scientific advancements. We're seeing more evidence for their potential to significantly accelerate healing, dramatically improve recovery times after hard workouts or injuries, and optimize overall health in various targeted ways. We're understanding the mechanisms better.
Right. Precision medicine, almost.
Kind of, yeah. A growing appreciation for their precision and ability to modulate specific biological pathways. But, and this is key, as with any emerging area, a nuanced understanding is vital. Balancing the immense potential with the crucial considerations for safe and effective use.
Always important.
It's about empowering you, the listener, with comprehensive, balanced knowledge to make informed decisions.
Okay, let's dive into some of the specific peptides generating the most discussion now, especially around injury recovery. This one, BBC 157, seems to be everywhere. What makes it so interesting, so effective for healing?
BBC 157, yeah. Body Protection Compound 157. It's truly fascinating stuff. Its main mechanism involves increasing something called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF.
VEGF, okay.
Which is a process it actually shares with other regenerative therapies you might have heard of, like platelet-rich plasma, PRP.
Ah, okay. Similar pathway.
Exactly. So essentially, BPC 157 works by promoting angiogenesis.
Angiogenesis, new blood vessel growth.
Precisely. The growth of small, new blood vessels. Think of an injured area, like a remote village cut off from supplies. BPC 157 acts like a rapid road builder.
Nice analogy.
These new blood vessels mean more plasma, more oxygen, more nutrients, and critically, more of your body's own natural growth factors and healing potential can get delivered right to that village of injured tissue faster and more efficiently.
So it helps the body heal itself better.
Exactly. We often call it a fuel injector for healing. It lets your body's own repair crew work at full capacity. This is also why modern rehab has moved away from, say, over-icing or chronic NSAIDs used for injuries.
Because those restrict blood flow.
Right. But they can actually hinder this vital natural healing process that BPC seems to enhance.
That fuel injector analogy is crystal clear. So right. Where does BPC 157 show the most promise? What kinds of injuries or conditions respond well?
It shows remarkable promise in a variety of conditions, particularly those involving connective tissue, soft tissue injuries. It works really well for chronic stuff like plantar fasciitis, that persistent heel pain.
Ugh, yeah, nasty one.
Tennis elbow. Or lateral epicondylitis, various shoulder issues like rotator cuff strains. It can also be quite helpful for knee osteoarthritis, where the increased blood flow helps the joint capsule and surrounding tissues. Similar idea to PRP there too.
Okay.
The increased blood flow and delivery of healing factors can really make a difference in speeding up recovery and reducing discomfort in those areas.
Any limitations? Areas where it might not work as well?
Yeah. Potentially.
Yeah.
For really deep, thick, and poorly vascularized tendons, like the Achilles tendon.
All right. Notoriously slow healing.
Exactly. It might not be as effective just because of the sheer density.
Mm.
It's harder for those new blood vessels to fully penetrate and establish a robust supply line deep inside.
Makes sense. Now, you mentioned considerations. What's the crucial one with DPC 157?
Okay. This is absolutely critical, and it requires thorough pre-use risk assessment. While BPC 157 has powerful localized effects where you might inject it near an injury, it also goes systemic. It circulates throughout your whole body.
Ah, okay. Didn't realize that.
Yeah. Therefore, it should absolutely not be taken if you have any existing tumors diagnosed or suspected, or even a high risk for certain cancers that you definitely don't want to grow.
Why is that?
Because the very mechanism that helps healing, increasing blood vessel growth, could potentially fuel the growth of existing cancerous cells by giving them an enhanced supply of nutrients and oxygen.
Wow. Okay. That is incredibly important.
It really is.
So for our listeners, how would someone even know if they have underlying risks that make BPC 157 potentially dangerous? What steps can they take?
This just underscores the absolute importance of routine general cancer screening tests. The ones recommended based on your age, gender, family history, other risk factors.
Like colonoscopies, mammograms.
Exactly. Things your primary care provider, your PCP, can help you navigate. Discussing colon cancer screening, cervical screening, prostate cancer screening for men after a conversation about risks and benefits.
Standard preventative care.
Right. And beyond those routine checks, if someone has a known high risk due to family history or genetics, maybe early cancer detection tests or specific imaging might be considered, but always in consultation with a doctor.
Sure.
The key is being proactive, informed about your baseline health, knowing your own physiological landscape before considering interventions with systemic effects, even promising ones like BPC-157.
Excellent advice. Okay, what about the growth hormone-releasing peptides, the GHRPs? We hear so much about growth hormone for recovery, muscle, anti-aging. How do peptides fit in here? How are they different from just taking HGH?
GHRPs offer a really elegant approach to optimizing growth hormone. They have a very similar risk-benefit profile to directly taking exogenous human growth hormone, HGH.
Okay.
But with a key difference, instead of putting outside growth hormone in, GHRPs work by naturally stimulating your body's own pituitary gland.
Ah, prompting your own system.
Exactly. Prompting it to produce and release more of its own growth hormone, ideally in a more natural, pulsatile way.
Pulsatile, like in bursts.
Yeah, that's how the body normally releases it, not just a constant high level. So GHRPs can effectively bring your growth hormone levels into a healthy, maybe more youthful physiological range.
Huh.
This offers great benefits for people with low risk factors looking to optimize their body's natural regenerative capacity.
So it's seen as maybe a more natural way to optimize.
Often, yeah. Here. Optimizing what your body already does rather than just replacing it entirely.
Okay. Are there different types of GHRPs? Do they have different effects or preferred uses? Sound like there might be options?
Yes, definitely several. And they each have unique characteristics. Tesamorelin, brand name Egrifta, is actually a personal favorite of mine.
Why is that?
Mostly because it's been extensively studied, and it actually has FDA approval for multiple indications, specifically for reducing belly fat in people with HIV-associated lipodystrophy.
Okay, that's significant validation.
It really is. It speaks volumes about its safety and efficacy from rigorous trials.
Yeah.
And it has what we call a Goldilocks half-life, meaning it doesn't clear too fast, so it works, but it doesn't hang around too long, causing constant non-physiological stimulation.
Yeah, just right.
Exactly. It allows it to mimic the body's natural pulsatile release from the pituitary, which is generally better physiologically, and avoids receptors getting desensitized.
Makes sense. What about others? I hear epamorelin mentioned a lot.
Yeah, epamorelin is generally preferred as a ghrelin agonist. Now, ghrelin is often called the hunger hormone.
Right, it makes you want to eat.
It does, and it also plays a role in growth hormone release. So a ghrelin agonist typically increases hunger. But epamorelin is kind of unique. While it stimulates GH release via that ghrelin receptor, it tends to do so with less intense hunger and significantly less impact on blood sugar compared to some others, like abutamorin or MK677.
Oh, okay. So fewer side effects, maybe.
Often, yeah. It makes it a more comfortable, predictable option for many people aiming to boost GH naturally without suddenly wanting to raid the fridge or having blood sugar swings.
Good to know. And CJC-1295, that one comes up too.
CJC-1295. Well, it's still used sometimes, but it's important to know its history. It actually failed phase 2 clinical trials because of a cardiac death.
Oh, wow.
Now, causality wasn't proven, not definitively linked to the compound, but it's a significant flag you need to be aware of. It can also increase blood volume, which can be a concern for some, and its half-life can be quite long compared to tesamorelin or samorelin, which, as we said, might be less ideal for maintaining that natural GH pulsing.
Okay. Important context there. So what are the main benefits people seek from boosting growth hormone with these GHRPs?
The classic benefits are usually profoundly better sleep quality, often deeper, more restorative sleep.
Everyone wants that.
Right. Also, accelerated recovery from physical exertion, whether that's tough workouts or actual injuries, and just an overall improved healing capacity for tissues throughout the body.
Sounds great. Any downsides besides the CJC history?
Well, an important note, again, tying back to pre-assessment, they can increase glucose levels.
Okay.
It's because growth hormone naturally has insulin antagonistic effects. It makes your cells slightly less sensitive to insulin. So this could potentially lead to a reversible form of diabetes, especially in people who already have some underlying insulin resistance or maybe just a low tolerance for glucose spikes.
So checking blood sugar beforehand is crucial.
Absolutely critical. Need a thorough pre-assessment of your metabolic health fasting glucose, HbA1c, maybe even insulin levels, before considering GHRPs.
Got it. Okay, shifting gears slightly. Beyond recovery and healing, we also see peptides popping up in cosmetic products, fancy serums, shampoos. Are those legit? Or just marketing hype using the peptide buzzword?
Yeah, aesthetic peptides definitely have their place, and they're often far from just gimmick. Things like GHK copper peptide or various hexapeptides, they're commonly put into shampoos, creams, serums.
What do they actually do?
Their main function is often supporting collagen and elastin production in the skin. This can help plump and hydrate the skin, giving it a more youthful, supple look. GHK copper peptide, for instance, also has anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties.
Okay.
Exopeptides, like one called argyrline, work a bit differently. They subtly inhibit muscle contractions, which can lead to a temporary smoothing effect on fine lines, kind of like Botox, but much, much milder.
Interesting.
And then you have melanocortin receptor agonists, like melanotan. Those are used aesthetically too, specifically to stimulate melanin production, giving you a tan without UV exposure.
Right, the tanning peptide.
Exactly. So these are distinct from the regenerative peptides we were just talking about. Their focus is more superficial skin and hair health, but they can be effective for those specific goals.
Are there any that are more gimmicky?
Well, maybe gimmick in the sense that they're more about clever delivery systems rather than a new biological action for the peptide itself. Like, there's a type of Botox called DAFI. It's just Botox bound to a large peptide instead of albumin, the usual carrier.
Ah, so the peptide is just the delivery truck.
Pretty much, yeah. Innovative delivery, but the active part is still the Botox. It's leveraging peptide science for delivery, not necessarily for the peptide's own bioactivity in that case.
I see the distinction. And one more regenerative one, TB500, sometimes mentioned alongside BPC-157.
Ah, yes, TB500. It's derived from a larger, naturally occurring peptide called thymosin beta-4.
Okay.
TB500 is often used because thymosin beta-4 itself was, well, technically too large, above arbitrary amino acid limits for compounding pharmacies to synthesize easily or legally in some contexts. So TB500, a shorter fragment, likely works very similarly.
And what does thymosin beta-4 do?
It's known for roles in cell migration, wound healing, reducing inflammation, and promoting angiogenesis, similar effects to BPC-157.
Ah, so they overlap.
They do, but maybe through slightly different pathways. Because of these overlapping yet distinct mechanisms, TB500 is often thought to be synergistic with BPC-157.
Meaning they work better together.
Potentially, yeah. Using them together might enhance each other's healing and regenerative effects, giving a more comprehensive approach to tissue repair, often used in combination protocols for injuries.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, it's clear peptides offer tremendous potential, but with all this buzz, especially from influencers who sometimes simplify things, happens a lot. What's frequently missed is that absolutely crucial pre-use risk assessment you keep mentioning. It feels like a vital step that gets skipped in the rush for quick solutions.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. The old saying, the dose is the poison, applies here maybe more than ever.
Right.
Whether you're considering a supplement, a prescription med, or a peptide, a similar structured approach to weighing the potential risks against the potential benefits is essential. Peptides aren't magic bullets.
Own reminder.
They're sophisticated biochemical tools that interact powerfully with your body's systems.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't use a power tool without safety checks, right? Same idea here.
Makes sense.
So if you're thinking about a growth hormone releasing peptide, for example, and you've done your homework, had assessments, and know you have a low risk of hypoglycemia and a low cancer risk, then bringing your growth hormone into a healthy physiological range could be incredibly beneficial for your overall health, vitality, longevity.
Yeah,
but it's that informed, conscious approach that matters. It's not that different from how we approach traditional hormone replacement therapy, just maybe a more nuanced way to optimize GH.
Right. Being proactive and responsible.
Exactly.
That distinction between magic bullet and sophisticated tool is excellent. And this leads us nicely into a broader foundational concept, hormone optimization. Seems deeply connected to how peptides work and their overall impact. Like, peptides are often one piece of a much bigger puzzle.
Precisely. You got it. Peptides interact intimately with our body's incredibly complex hormonal systems. Hormones are the fundamental messengers regulating pretty much everything. Metabolism, mood, energy, recovery, you name it.
Yeah, they run the show.
Pretty much. So understanding these interconnected systems is absolutely key to truly optimizing health and getting the most benefit from any intervention, peptides included. We have several major categories.
Okay, what are they?
First, the steroid-based hormones. These are all made from cholesterol. Think estrogens, androgens like testosterone and DHT.
DHT.
Dihydrotestosterone, a potent androgen. Also progestogens, glucocorticoids like cortisol, the stress hormone, and even vitamin D, which functions like a steroid hormone.
Wow, vitamin D too.
Yeah. And interestingly, you don't actually need to eat cholesterol to make these. Mm. Your body's pretty good at making cholesterol itself if needed.
Okay. What's next?
Then you have the peptide hormones, which we've been focusing on today. Growth hormone, insulin, oxytocin, lots of others. Chains of amino acids, usually binding to receptors on the cell surface.
Got it. And the third type?
Amino acid-based hormones. derived from single amino acids. Examples are dopamine, adrenaline, or epinephrine, norepinephrine. These often act as both hormones and neurotransmitters, regulating mood, focus, fight or flight response.
Okay.
And all these systems are incredibly interconnected. They influence each other constantly in complex ways.
Speaking of steroid hormones and overall health, what about things like statins? So many people take them for cholesterol. Do they impact hormones or other things relevant to peptides?
They do, though often subtly. But it's worth considering in a holistic view. Statins can slightly decrease total testosterone levels, usually only by about 10 nanograms per deciliter.
Is that significant?
For most people, probably not clinically significant in terms of like sudden hormonal symptoms. However, what can be significant and is often overlooked is that statins have been linked to contributing to tendon issues. Tendinopathy risk goes up.
Really? Didn't know that.
Yeah. And this is relevant because people with high cholesterol, even before statins, are already at a slightly increased risk for tendon problems. So it's another factor potentially stressing connective tissues.
Or maybe regenerative peptides could play a role.
Potentially supportive for some, yeah. And not a direct counter to the statin effect, but part of that bigger picture of tissue health.
Okay. So for someone wanting to get a clearer picture of their own hormonal landscape beyond just the basics at a checkup, what specific lab tests are really vital? What should people look at for hormonal health and longevity?
Great question. This is where you can really get empowered with actionable knowledge. Several labs are key. One crucial marker is sex hormone binding globulin, or SHBG.
SHBG, okay. What does it do?
Think of it like a transport bus. It binds up sex hormones, mostly testosterone and estradiol, making them inactive until they hop off the bus.
So high SHBG means less active hormone.
Exactly. Now, generally, higher SHBG is seen as better if your free hormones, the unbound active ones, are still adequate. But consistently very high SHBG is correlated with an increased risk of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's.
Why is that?
Likely because even if your total T&E look okay on paper, the amount of free active hormone that can actually get into tissues like the brain and do protective things might be too low. Free estrogen, for example, is vital for nerve insulation, myelination.
Okay, yeah. Can you lower high SHBG?
You can aim to optimize it. Naturally increasing androgen levels can sometimes help lower it. Also, be aware that things like thyroid hormone replacement or estrogen-only HRT postmenopause can significantly increase SHBG. There are even free online calculators where you can plug in your total T and SHBG to estimate your free androgen index.
Useful. What else?
Next, testosterone. And crucially for females too, not just men.
Right. Important point.
Absolutely. Estimates suggest maybe 80% of women could potentially benefit from testosterone optimization or replacement for things like metabolic health, energy, bone density, mood, and yes, libido.
Even though it's not FDA approved for women.
Correct. Currently, there's no specific FDA approved T-PrEP for women, so it's often prescribed off-label. But the clinical benefits are pretty clear when done properly by knowledgeable practitioners, especially given the huge natural variation in female T levels. Anywhere from 10 to 100 nanograms per deciliter is considered normal. It highlights the need for individual assessment.
Okay. Anything specific about testosterone use, especially for women?
Yes, DHT conversion is a big one. Topical testosterone creams applied to the skin can lead to surprisingly high conversion to DHT right there in the skin because of enzymes present. In women, this can cause unwanted masculinizing side effects. Thicker, oilier skin, more body hair, maybe hair thinning on the scalp. Androgenic alopecia?
Not ideal.
Not usually, no. Subcutaneous testosterone injections, however, tend to bypass a lot of that initial skin conversion, so they often result in much less DHT elevation and fewer of those side effects for women.
Good to know. And for men worried about hair loss from T?
That's where drugs like finasteride or dutasteride come in. They inhibit the enzyme, 5-alpha reductase, that converts T to DHT. Dutasteride is stronger, blocks more enzymes, often only needed once or twice a week. Interestingly, dutasteride has also been studied off-label for severe PMS, or PMDD, in women.
Huh. Okay. What about naturally boosting testosterone? Lots of supplements claim to do that.
Yeah, but let's be clear. It's usually not about magical boosters creating ki from nothing. It's about identifying and fixing what might be blackballing or actively suppressing your natural production.
Like what?
Could be huge damage to the testes, physical trauma, even a past pituitary injury. Deficiencies in key nutrients like vitamin D, zinc, selenium are common culprits. Chronically high cortisol from stress or low LH signal from the pituitary.
Okay.
So supplements like boron, magnesium, zinc, ashwagandha, Tonkadali, Long Jack, they can help by addressing these potential blocks. Zinc is needed for T synthesis. Ashwagandha can lower cortisol. Boron might lower SHBG.
Oh.
They check those boxes.
Gotcha. Addressing the root cause.
Exactly. What else? For males considering TRT, sperm quantification is crucial. Know your baseline before starting, as TRT suppresses natural production. Banking sperm is an option for future fertility.
Smart planning.
Also often overlooked, sleep apnea is actually the second most common cause of low testosterone.
Really? Why?
The chronic lack of oxygen and disrupted sleep severely messes with the pituitary's LH release, tanking T production. Treating sleep apnea can dramatically improve T levels.
Yow. Okay. What else on the lab list?
Metabolic syndrome. This whole cluster. Insulin resistance, high body fat, especially belly fat, cholesterol issues, high blood pressure. A DEXA scan is invaluable here. It accurately measures body fat percentage. Aim for under 25% for men, under 35% for women, generally speaking, for better hormonal health.
And tracking blood sugar.
Yes. Continuous glucose monitor, CGMs, are fantastic tools and becoming more accessible over the counter. Seeing your real-time glucose response to food and activity is incredibly empowering for managing insulin resistance. Some newer ones even track ketones and alcohol.
Very cool. Two more, maybe.
Okay, quickly. Prolactin and IGF-1. Checking these can be important. If they're elevated, it might hint at a pituitary microadenoma, a small, usually benign tumor. Common enough to warrant checking, often with an MRI, especially if LH, FSH are low. Prolactin also spikes post-orgasm, contributing to that sleepy feeling.
Ah, the postcoital chill.
Exactly. And finally, DHEA sulfate. DHEAS, especially important for women. It's mainly from the adrenal glands, a precursor hormone. High DHEAs might predict an easier menopause transition. Very low DHEAs can signal adrenopause, potentially leading to worse symptoms like hot flashes and anxiety. Considering DHEA or low-dose T before menopause, if DHEAs is very low, might smooth the transition.
That's a ton of great info on labs. So ultimately, with all these peptides, hormones, labs, it always comes back to the fundamentals, doesn't it? Diet and lifestyle, the bedrock.
Absolutely, 100%. Lifestyle is without doubt the biggest lever you can pull for health and longevity. When it comes to nutrition, a simple guideline. Aim for at least 80% whole foods.
Veggies, fruits, lean protein, healthy fats.
Exactly. Unprocessed or minimally processed stuff. Now, that doesn't mean you can never have processed food. The goal is sustainable adherence, not orthorexia, that unhealthy obsession with perfect eating.
Right. Balance.
Balance. Focus on consistent good choices. Avoid trans fats. Limit excess added sugar. Cut down on liquid calories. For most people carrying extra weight, a safe, sustainable caloric deficit is profoundly beneficial for metabolic health.
And protein. You mentioned its importance.
Huge. Protein is a powerful anti-obesity tool. Keeps you full, helps manage calories, and crucially, supports lean muscle mass vital for metabolism and aging well.
Any nuances with protein sources? Animal versus plant.
Animal proteins are generally complete, high in leucine for muscle building, but also methionine. If your homocysteine levels and inflammatory marker are high, you might want to buffer methionine intake. Collagen, interestingly, is low in methionine.
How do you buffer methionine or lower homocysteine?
Supplements like creatine, maybe 7.5 grams daily, and betaine, TMG, can help support methylation pathways and lower homocysteine.
Okay. And red meat, always controversial.
It is. But unprocessed red meat, and especially bison, offer significant health benefits. Super nutrient-dense iron, B vitamins, zinc, selenium, a robust multivitamin profile. And remember, most saturated fat in the typical American diet comes from processed junk food and desserts, not lean, unprocessed meat.
Good point. And bison.
Bison is incredibly lean, nutrient-rich, and even has potential environmental benefits through regenerative grazing. Great option.
Fascinating. Beyond diet, what about environmental pollutants? Microplastics, PFAS? Should we be worried? What can we do?
It's a valid concern, yes. Chronic exposure is real. Microplastics. Well, some promising research suggests we can actually sweat them out.
Really? Sweating helps.
Seems so. Which highlights why regular sweating through exercise, sauna, is likely a crucial health practice for detoxification. As for PFAS, the forever chemicals, they're everywhere. The good news is the EPA is now actively testing for them in water treatment plants. A step in the right direction.
Okay. And quickly, pregnancy nutrition. Key things.
Iron and activated vitamin A retinoids are critical.
Mm.
Many women, especially active ones, are low in iron. A healthy whole food diet plus a good quality capsule multivitamin, generally better absorbed than tablets, is highly recommended to cover all bases for mom and baby.
Wow, what a deep dive indeed. We've truly covered so much ground today. from the basics of what peptides even are, their intricate workings, to specific examples like BPC-157 for healing, GHRPs for recovery, always stressing that vital personalized risk assessment.
So important.
Then widening out to hormone optimization, those key labs you outline, and bringing it all back to the absolute foundation, diet and lifestyle. It's all connected, isn't it?
Indeed it is. I think the key takeaway is that peptides are incredibly powerful tools, really exciting potential for health optimization regeneration. But like any powerful tool, they require understanding, careful thought, and ideally, guidance from knowledgeable healthcare providers who get the nuances.
Right.
And what really stands out is just how interconnected everything is: hormones, diet, environment, and the need for critical thinking about the health info you find, especially online.
Absolutely. And that connection is a perfect thought to leave you, our listeners, with. How can you take this nuanced understanding of peptides and these broader health principles to empower your own journey towards well-being, always seeking that balanced, informed approach that honors your unique body? This deep dive was brought to you by InfinityPeptide.com. Thank you so much for joining us on this enlightening journey today. Until next time, keep digging deeper into what truly makes you well.